listeners, have you ever tried to record an intro to a podcast with a cat aggressively sitting on your lap and leaning on your keyboard? Well, if you haven't, it's a little bit of a pain. I wish I could blame Ifrit, that's the cat, for the fact that it's taken us well over a month to produce the second half of our discussion of David Campbell's writing Security, but I'm afraid that's all on me and my inability to balance podcast responsibilities with the needs of pandemic pedagogy. Nonetheless, we are looking forward to 2021, when we hope to go back to our initial schedule of recording a new episode every month and then splitting into two because we are constitutionally incapable of talking for less than 2 to 3 hours. A few heads up, if you don't know what you're listening to, this is Whiskey and International Relations Theory, the podcast where Patrick Jackson and Dan Nexon is me, drink whiskey and talk about a work of international relations theory, usually a classic, often one that had some kind of influence over our intellectual development, but sometimes we pick something newer. This is not one of those cases, emphatically. David Campbell's writing Security, as you will have heard if you listened to the prior episode, influenced both of us a great deal, although neither of us are doing the kind of work that David Campbell advocates. And that's a topic that we take up at the end of the podcast when we discuss the influence of writing Security, the paths that might not have been taken in the field, the reasons why those paths weren't taken, and the often tense relationship between the pioneers of the kind of work that David Campbell was doing and the constructivists who tried to, in Emanuel Adler's words, seize the middle ground. So with that being said, you can get our whiskey selection from the prior episode. If you want to follow us on Twitter, our handle is @WhiskeyIRT, and we're going to dive right in now.
Up to this point, Robert Campbell's developed he's developed this analytic of the two different foreign policies and the way that these are really rhetorics of otherness and logics of fear, and we've got to follow how these things work. Then you get into basically this run of chapters 4, 5, 6, 7 that I don't want to say are the empirical payoff, but they also kind of are, because this is where Campbell really starts to go into the specifics of U.S. foreign policy and the kinds of things that drive it. Though Chapter 4 is a little broader than just the United States, because Chapter 4 is really a genealogy of the disease metaphor and the figuration of danger, a very long genealogy, and sort of runs back to thinking about the body politique and the notion of the polity as a body, and the polity as a body can then be susceptible to disease, and in the same way that the body is susceptible to diseases, then the body politic can also be susceptible to disease, and that calls for certain kinds of public defense mechanisms to try to keep the diseases out, and so on. And Campbell traces this and shows how ubiquitous this particular framing is, how these disease notions have a really long history to them, and in particular a really long history of use that makes them, in a sense, always available. So, and whenever anybody is looking to try to talk about danger, it's like, this is one of the metaphors that just leaps quickly to mind because it's so well established in the tradition. Nobody has to make that up. You can just start talking about the invaders as vermin, and then, oh, okay, that sort of resonates with other kinds of notions that have been used in the same kind of idiom over the years. So it's basically the genealogy of why it is that this continues to be a recurrent gesture.
So one way of reading this is that there's a set of very deeply structured representational elements. The body and the body politic is one of those. Domestic civil society, domestic society as in terms of this Habesian metaphor. Another way, of course, is to think about locally specific discourses bootstrapping on one another. It's not just the availability of the body metaphor that allows us to talk about things like disease, but talking about disease itself is reproductive of the body metaphor. I can't recall, and my notes don't make clear whether he does both or not.
The analysis in my memory and my notes is more about the way that the body metaphor sort of gives rise to these sort of the capacity of representing danger as disease. So because the way he's got the chapter divided up, he has the body politique kind of emerging first, And then a few pages later, this starts talking and informing different kinds of representations of danger. So there's a way that the history of the body politique is the condition of possibility for these different kinds of danger metaphors, particularly disease metaphors that he argues are quite recurrent. Now, one thing though that's interesting here that he sort of gestures at but doesn't really go into is the link between the history of the deployment of these notions and their continued present tense efficacy. So, yes, he can show that these things have been used in order to jump from they have been used to they will continue to work when they are used now. You kind of need something a little bit more than he's really giving us here. Because, again, I think mostly what he's trying to do is more of a Foucauldian history of the present. We see these things happening now. Clearly, the punchline of this book is the end of the Cold War, because that's where he started the book. And that's what he's gone back into the past to kind of get back to that point. And so in this sense, it's all he's trying to do is just document that these things were used, and he's able to do that. He can't really tell us why, but that's not really his point here. His point is just to excavate what the origins of these things that we're still using actually are. So, though it's interesting that in that section he continues to reject the idea that these things are causal, that the use of these sorts of metaphors is he says it's not causal. They don't, the deployment of these metaphors don't cause particular things to happen. And again, as we said before, I get why he's saying that, but I think it's an unfortunate phrasing. Now, it didn't seem unfortunate to me when I read it as an undergrad, but it seemed unfortunate to me. Honestly, it seemed unfortunate to me when I was trying to actually do work in this idiom and realizing that actually I was trying to make causal claims. And they just weren't causal claims in the generalization causal claim kind of sense.
If you do that, I think you're thinking about the causation the wrong way. He is interested in the sense that he genuflects towards the kinds of conditions of possibility that emerge from these kinds of metaphors in discourses. In this chapter, though, he doesn't have a lot to say about them. They start to really kind of do work, I think, later. Mm-hmm. Here we have more of an accounting. Mm-hmm. But remember that it's not that he's trying to say, because we shifted from a miasma conception of disease to a viral conception of disease, that had certain implications for the way that that shift then enables us to understand anarchists as viruses and viral contamination, which then enables certain kinds of boundary regulating techniques that have a socio-medical aspect to them. I mean, it's interesting because he doesn't really go there, does he? Anyway, you could do that whole argument. That's not really the argument. Is that we can understand, right? That once we understand what foreign policy is or how foreign policy works. Not what foreign policy is. And once we understand the role of foreign policy in boundary drawing in particular, in maintaining boundaries, in writing security or what have you, it's then that we can see the work that is being, we can see why these metaphors, these discourses are bootstrapping on one another, why they get reached forward and how they get deployed. I don't think he's really very interested here in their effects. And this is the interesting thing. It's so naturalized that we don't think about it as a puzzle. Why in the world does a disease metaphor have anything to do with immigration or transnational violence-wielding entrepreneurs, right? Chuck would call terrorists, right? Mm-hmm. You know, why use that at all? Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense at some level. It should be a puzzle, right? Mm-hmm. And once we turn it into a puzzle, then we can say, oh, right, of course, because we have this very potent metaphor of the body politic as the thing that needs to be secured. And then these kinds of discourses of danger, practices of threat management are how we then secure this identity that can never be secured, right? We call this identity to existence, we bound it, and we give it meaning. Then, of course, we reach for the disease metaphor. Mm-hmm. So I think that's sort of how I read the power of the argument. But it requires you to take the step of saying, oh, wait a minute, this is kind of weird, mm-hmm. which I don't think this is something that we're so used to that I don't think we view it as puzzling.
No, the great thing about a good genealogy is precisely that it takes the thing that is sort of unquestionably obvious and opens it up and says, okay, so why exactly are these things connected together? There is something odd about about the phrasing of it, though, right? Because logically, if we take the argument that Campbell's making here, then logically, a change in the dominant set of metaphors that we had for thinking about the polity might shift the kinds of rhetorics of danger that would be used to shore it up. And I think about something like Steph Fischel's book on the microbial state, where she basically makes this argument that once we start shifting our understanding of disease, then we end up with very different kinds of discourses of state identity. So you get a different version, a different kind of coupling of these things. If one side shifts, then the other side starts shifting. And I think that's there. I don't think that's inconsistent with Campbell. I just think it's a different way of cutting into the same material.
You want to see more of that because that's the kind of argument you like and the kind of argument you make. That's the same reason I want to see more of that. That's coming from a presumption. This is a brush clearing exercise. I mean, I don't mean to reduce it to that, but it is an attempt to reorient thinking about foreign policy.
Yeah.
And you got to do that reorientation. And his job, and I think he can point to examples of this, but I think doing a systematic analysis of how this particular discursive configuration or this particular repertoire of practices makes certain things like this rather than like that. You know, that's not what he's interested in here. I mean, what he's actually interested in here is showing us that this is foreign policy without the capital F, capital P, right? That's the punchline of this chapter, is that AIDS, medicalization of deviance, medicalization of minorities, the whole way in which these things keep on circulating, reproducing in similar ways, that this is policies involving forwardness. And deciding who, you know, in the Schmittian sense, who is inside and who is outside. Mm-hmm. And so in that there is then a kind of predictability to the ways in which the same stuff happens again and again and again. So in the same manner, we can note, this is on 98, we can note how various groups within American and European domestic society have been constituted as marginal through the figurations of socio-medical discourse. Mm-hmm. Women, Black, and Jews have at one time or another all been understood as uniquely susceptible to certain disorders. Women were diagnosed as exhibiting a high incidence of hysteria. Jews in general were believed to be prone to psychological disorders. Jewish men were thought to menstruate like women and thus be a source of social pollution. Blacks were overwhelmingly considered insane. For each of these groups, sexuality was medicalized as a pathology and indicted as a threat to the integrity of the body politic. So again, this is foreign policy. Yeah, so the next chapter is Imagining America. Mm-hmm. A lot of Todorov, if you know Conquest of America.
A lot of Todorov.
This is firmly in your arena.
Yeah, I mean, chapter five is fantastic. Chapter five is also one of the things that is kind of problematic, I would say, about the argument. And it is the place where it's like there's two different versions of this argument. There's these kinds of dilemmas are specific to, or at least more complicated in, the United States. And then there's, these are general dilemmas that you find in all sorts of polities, and this is the particular way they happen to manifest with this polity called the United States. And Campbell kind of goes back and forth between these two, because he wants to suggest that the U.S. is the imagined community par excellence, which is a phrase he uses a couple of times. And This leads him to what I think is a slight misreading of Todorov, actually. In the second edition, it's on page 96. I have to see where it is in the first edition. But in the second edition, there's on 96, he's talking specifically about Todorov. It's the end of the section right before encountering Amerindians. But he's making an argument that Todorov is talking about America. And I don't think that Todorov is talking about America. Todorov is talking about Columbus having a certain kind of a general hermeneutic that he's using to try to interpret things. So, which is not specifically about America per se. It's about a finalist form of interpretation that puts everything within a biblical context. So I don't think that necessarily that Todorov is Todorov is not writing about America as a discrete polity in the way that Campbell is. And I think Todorov is trying to get at something that is a bit more, not universal, but a bit more widespread, shall we say, than just America per se. I mean, Todorov himself defines his topic as being basically about a sort of dilemma that occurs within liberalism and modernity per se. You know, how do you have difference with equality? In that way, like, Todorov is kind of like Tocqueville. Like, they're talking about America, but they're using it as an instance of something else that they're trying to talk about. And Campbell isn't. I mean, or at least sometimes he's not. Sometimes he's not using the experience of the United States as a way of talking about security in general. But sometimes he is. Campbell really wants to draw a much more straightforward point from Todorov, which is that the Europeans did not acknowledge the personhood of the native peoples that they ran into, that they kind of effaced them from the narrative. And yes, that's true, but it's more complex than that. There's more going on there. Because again, remember, the bigger structure this has to fit into for Campbell is that why the United States is the imagined community par excellence is precisely because it doesn't have an ethnic base on which to fall. There's no single ethnic thing that's there. So it's not as if there are people who've always been there who can then claim, oh, we've always been there. No, he has to show the people who were always there were precisely not acknowledged as having already been there. And then the settlers were able to come in and kind of drive them off or hybridize and give them smallpox, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a variety of eliminations that go on here. So it serves the broader argument, but I think it's not exactly the most nuanced reading of Todorov.
We need to push on, but I do want to... There is something about this chapter that reminds... This history is very stylized, and even though the history is always stylized in these chapters because he's interested in discourse, he's interested in getting us to a certain place, he's engaged in critical genealogies, it didn't bug me in the medicalized thing. It didn't bug me in chapter 4 the way it bugs me in this chapter. And I think part of it is that the line between saying this is the kind of identity formulation or representation of America in the United States, and this is the historical account of how that happened, the line between that is fairly thin. So we're not really getting something like a deconstructive history here. Right, I think, in the way that I would, or deconstructive, not in the Derridian sense, but in a, right. we're not getting an incisive history of counter narrative, if right. that makes sense.
Right. If I can just quickly, for a second, jump ahead to something. Mm-hmm. So there's a chapter in the first edition that isn't in the second edition, right? And that's the Japan chapter. Mm-hmm. So there's a chapter which in the first edition is, I believe, chapter 8, Rewriting Security 2, which simply isn't in the second edition. And the reason why I'm jumping ahead just for 1 second to that chapter is because in the first edition, on page 228, he is quoting from a work by, I believe it's James Fallows, which he's treating as a primary source, right? So he's looking at a particular way in which the otherness of Japan is being characterized, right? So he's reading this on, quoting from this on page 228. And the quote is, "America is a land of people bound not by some mystical tribal tie, but by the desire to be in America, the imagined community par excellence." That's from a primary source. So you've got a bleed through here of the discourse of identity and the history of identity. They're sort of colliding with each other in ways that I think exactly make the point that you were making about the ambiguity of chapter 5. It's unclear sometimes whether we are talking about an analytic or whether we are talking about a historical account. And the two of them seem to kind of bleed into each other. in various sorts of ways, in ways that make it very difficult to answer the question, like, is America really the imagined community par excellence? Or is it just the case that the discourse of identity in America envisions itself as the imagined community par excellence, and therefore certain kinds of consequences follow from that particular configuration of identity, because the United States understands itself as not having an ethnic base? Certainly there's a way of understanding the United States as having an ethnic base in the sort of current present-day narratives of white supremacy in the United States would point out, no, there is a kind of ethnic core that's been imagined and produced at the dominant heart of the United States, and it's wrapped up with chattel slavery and the, you know, driving the Native Americans off the land and so on and so forth. But so in a sense, there is a kind of ethnic core. And what's been happening in certain parts of American political discourse recently is that that core is then being more explicitly on display than it had been in the past. So there's an entirely different way of reading America, which wouldn't invalidate the imagined community par excellence claim if that were a claim not specific to America, but if that were a claim about states in general, that states are always imagined and are always imagined in terms of the others against which they are differentiated. So if we kept it as an analytic, then you could make it work. But if that claim is supposed to be specific about the United States, what are we doing here? Are we just reproducing the idea that the American polity has of itself as being this centerless polity that doesn't actually have an ethnic core? It gets really confusing at this point. And I think you're right to call attention to that in Chapter 5. There's a way that Chapter 5 could be read as an official history rather than an analytical account of the discourse.
That being said, it's an official history that emphasizes nasty shit done by Europeans, both to Amerindians and to one another. Mm-hmm. So there is a logic to the events he focuses on. There's a logic to highlighting the XYZ affair in the Alien Sedition Acts. There's a logic to highlighting the implication of Native Americans in both the establishment and perpetuation of colonies, but also their erasure and their destruction. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's all of that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah, and I agree that there is a presumption here that the Democratic National Convention of 2016 is the way we conceptualize our identity and not the Republican National Convention of 2016. And this is important because it's not that Trumpism, for example, the ethnic nationalism at the core of Trumpism is an interesting ethno-nationalism because it's an ethno-nationalism which does not entirely dispense with civic identity, right? Hmm. So it's because you can participate in, you can be an American citizen if you are black or brown or otherwise a racial minority or a religious minority, but you have to do it on the terms of the dominant ethnicity. Which is to say that it's very much like the Proud Boys, you know, inducting Hispanics and other people of color, but making, I don't know if this is still the case, but making them pledge to uphold Western civilization and the achievements, I think, of the West. I don't know whether it's actually white race or not, but you know, so there's a sense in which you can be allied to the project without being of the right identity. But it's still, you have to sort of accept a narrative, a way of teaching America, which is focused on a white ethnocentric conception. And this taps into a very long tradition of, you know, you have maybe a U.S. citizen, but you're not an American.
Right. To sort of flip the, because we've been sort of critically pushing on Campbell a little bit, Campbell's own logic would actually help us, or Campbell's analytic would help us understand this very, very well, because precisely you've got the, you can never really be inside. Well, there's always the possibility you can always be re-ruled again as being still on the outside. And, of course, that differentiation, if we take Campbell seriously, that differentiation, since there's precisely because there's no final core to it, can always be reproduced. It's a set of mobile distinctions that can be utilized in different ways for different sorts of political purposes.
I mean, it's very clear when he taught from Chapter 4 that he's well aware, engaged with, you know, ethno-nationalist variants of American identity, but you're right. I mean, there is this kind of assumption here that somehow identity forms that piggyback on kinship in-groups, right? Which is what nationalism is. Mm-hmm. It's an extension of the kin. It's a claim about the extent of the kin group. Mm-hmm. That they are somehow more, not rooted, but relatively more rooted than any civic conception. You know, I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I don't know.
And for me, the question is, even if one were to make that claim, are we making that claim simply as an empirical observation about how things have functioned? Or is there some ex ante theoretical reason why we should expect that to be the case? And that's the kind of ambiguity here. I'll just be blunt about it. I think you could do Campbell's analysis in a country that was not the United States very easily. I think you could use the same notions and talk about rhetorics of danger, differentiation of different kinds of foreign elements, the interpenetration of the inside and the outside. I think you see the same thing. I mean, like the Brexit debate is basically, you could run this and get quite a lot of interesting insight into what's going on in the UK. And you know, there are debates about the European Union and about the joining of the European Union that I think you could sort of very easily do the same kind of thing with. So I don't know that, I don't know what, this is why I keep coming back to not quite knowing what to make of this claim that somehow the United States is the imagined community par excellence. Because if that were true, that would sort of be a scope condition for the theory, and I don't think that's true. I think that this theory doesn't have the scope condition of being, like, specific to the United States. But then what does that do to the claim, right?
So are we getting this wrong, right? Is the imagined community par excellence that it is an imagined community par excellence because it requires extra special imaginative sauce? Because he does have this contrast with, say, what we call ethno-national identity. Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? Or is an imagined community because it is a community that is expressly, as you put it earlier, expressly self-aware of its imagination as crucial to its self. Right?
And I don't know. I don't know which one of those two he's really going for here. Mm-hmm. Is it an empirical claim about America? Or is it a theoretical claim about the importance of certain kinds of identity rhetorics versus others?
You can think about this in the way you think about the deployment of the idea of America. Mm-hmm. Because the deployment of the idea of America is always something to which we are striving towards, right? It's always an imagined endpoint. It's never realized. So we are always in a state of becoming in a lot of our, even our ethno-nationalist discourse, posit us in always being in a state of becoming, never mm-hmm. a state of being.
Right.
But that might be true of other national identities, you know, that I'm not as familiar with. It's certainly true of Canadian national identity, I think.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of other settler colonial countries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has, it's overstated. But yes, I think we agree that it would be a much stronger claim if he were not contrasting it with national identity, but he were talking about the imagination of America as imagined, the idea of America as imagined, or the idea that America is an idea, that it is something that we have to imagine constantly, not mm-hmm. something that we can ever really truly live at any given moment,
right?
Or at least we can never fully live, right? It's always in the future.
Mm-hmm.
That's the source of the aporia. That's the source of the contingency, the undecidability. So we are constantly trying to restore it, or we're constantly trying to progress it forward. We can never stand here and say, okay, this is America. The next chapter is really the Cold War chapter, right?
Yep.
So, I mean, there's more stuff about identity and frontiers and Kennedy and domestic surveillance and getting rid of the commies.
The thing that I walk away from it with is the striking continuities in the ways that the American identity is sort of reinscribed throughout all of these different periods and over these different domains. So you've got the recurrence of the notion of civilized versus savage that we had back in Chapter 5. It shows up in the discourse on labor activism and labor activists as being savages. And you end up with the sort of the red thing that keeps going on throughout your various kinds of red scares. So what the whole chapter seems to establish is there's a very restricted repertoire of self-other images that keep recurring over and over and over again. And people innovate. They're innovating by combining them in different ways, but the basic vocabulary is still pretty constant. which is absolutely fascinating. And I think he does a really nice job demonstrating that, sort of, you know, in the Foucauldian sense, like demarcating the boundaries of the archive. This is everywhere you look, you see these same kinds of things on display. There's a ubiquity to it, which is, I think, really, really well documented.
And we see it right now, right? Yeah. With the Chinese virus, fears of the rise of China that are not contained mm-hmm. to Trumpism, mm-hmm. discourses about Antifa and urban chaos, right? It's all kind of the same stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it was Yehuda Weldes who first used this particular allusion. She's the first person I remember using this, talking about it as being there's a kind of myth bank, and people keep withdrawing from the bank, but there's only a few things in the bank, and the history, the chapter 4, chapter 5 genealogy has sort of gotten us to the point where in chapter 6 we can say, oh, okay, look, this is what they're drawing on, this is what they have available to them, look at how they're going to continue drawing on these things, and look how they're drawing on them, not just for public consumption, but they're drawing on it for themselves.
I was just gonna say, it's like conspiracy theory. You know, sort of, there are a couple of major templates for Western conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. We ultimately wind up with the same story. It's just, you know, sometimes it's the Jews, and sometimes it's the lizard people, and sometimes it's the cabal, I think is the current version of the right. protocol, of the elders who are drinking blood and that mm-hmm. sort of thing, right? Yeah. So it's the same script. That is, in fact, essentially how a lot of our conspiracy theories have worked over the years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, QAnon is like the bad remix of a bunch of these things, but there's nothing unusual there. It's like, oh, no, we've read this script before. It's just it had different names last time. But we've seen this, and these are the same kinds of things that have been campaigned against. So there is something about that. Now, what's interesting about Chapter 6, though, it's a good persistent documentation of the recurrence of these things in the articulation of American foreign policy. What it isn't, and to its credit, what it doesn't pretend to be, is an explanation for why the set remains as closed as it is. It's a good demonstration that the set is relatively closed, that these things keep coming up again and again and again. But there really isn't, because it's not really the point of the exercise to try to explain why we can't sort of imagine anything else. So it's, but again, because it's a piece of critical intervention, but he's primarily trying to do here is to try to suggest that maybe we should try to think differently about this. But let me first do this by documenting exactly how we haven't been thinking differently about this. And so you can see exactly how persistent it is and how much it recurs.
Although it is a little bit odd, and maybe, again, this is age, the date of our education, what have you. I think if you asked people who had some knowledge of the quote-unquote Cold War, right, they would not have any problem shifting to a conversation of, say, domestic anti-communism as mm-hmm. part of that. Mm-hmm. This would not be seen as distinct for them.
Right.
So to some degree, I think it's also what this chapter allows him to do is take essentially a case we know, mm-hmm. particularly if you're reading this in 1992, you know about McCarthyism, you know about the domestic surveillance by the CIA, you know about radicalism of various sorts and conflicts, particularly in the 60s, you know about J. Edgar Hoover. Mm-hmm. So all of this stuff is already linked into your experience of the Cold War, although at the same time it is something that is going to get increasingly whitewashed out of the Cold War. Right, increasingly forgotten,
right.
Usually invoked by, to be honest, leftist anti-Trumpers, right, who are saying, you know, things aren't so bad, and my usual, you know my position on that. That's what happened before is why we should be scared, because it's all happening again.
Yeah.
You're right. We have sucked a lot, and that shows just how far south we can go.
Exactly. Exactly.
I think what I would say here is that it is all the same thing all over again.
It's there's nothing new. This is these are older techniques that are simply recurring. No, it is
a conspiracy, man.
It is, totally. If you believed that a speech act always needed to have a pre-constituted speaker, then conspiracy theory would be the logical conclusion. But if instead we look at these as just, you know, dispersed actions, and you can think about it as a conceptual economy, then the continuity of these things doesn't necessarily require there to be somebody standing back there pulling the strings. You could see where if one didn't quite understand the theoretical context of this, then you'd say, okay, so who's writing these scripts?
The next chapter is on the war on drugs, and it is pretty much what you would expect. if you have followed the train of argument and you know something about the history of the war on drugs. I felt very much like I was back in the 1990s debating drug legalization, because there you have... it is easy to forget how, like, nutty some of this stuff got by the late 1980s. Narco-guerrillas, narco-terrorism, narcotics as a pollution, as an outside force polluting the body politic, but also an internal cancer, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's particularly interesting, of course, because the war on drugs is also Exhibit A for securitization theory. Although I don't know how often it's used, for me, mentally, it's Exhibit A, because we have a war on drugs, and very quickly we get things like exceptions to the Fourth Amendment predicated on the particular exigencies of the war on drugs, which allow seizure well beyond what had been legal before, or searches that would have once been considered unconstitutional, that you even talk about a drug exception to the Fourth Amendment. So you see those dynamics very much in the war on drugs. He pushes them back earlier, and which is cool. You get to sort of see it unfold. But also, I think primarily about the 1980s, which is when we grew up. So there's that. I mean, it's a fairly straightforward argument to us now. Certainly post-securitization theory, it's, yeah, of course. But I think, I don't know at the time how it would have been read. I mean, it is, again, it's interesting because the war on drugs had already been constituted, had gone from being a war on drugs to a war on this broader nexus, which was clearly then identified as sort of even typical external violence, right? Typical guerrillas, insurgents, commies, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then moreover, he has, of course, the discussion of Iran-Contra and the way in which the United States is itself kind of, you know, it's a little funky there. Mm-hmm. So
mm-hmm. It's a good illustration of the self-other dynamics circulating through domains that aren't necessarily just confined to formal foreign policy. It's an interesting choice because it also shows that the direction of transfer of these self-other dichotomies isn't always from small f, small p foreign policy to capital, but can also go the other way. Because throughout, as he's talking about the war on drugs, he's also showing how some of the same notions that were being used in anti-communist policies were then sort of being adapted and brought in to the framing of drugs. So you've actually got kind of a bidirectional flow. It's not just from the broader cultural context to the policies, but also from past policies to cultural context. So the fear surrounding drugs, which is then framed by drawing on the same kinds of things that were being used to frame the fears of communism. And then you see the same thing showing up.
I was looking at old educational... I was looking at old American educational films, of which there are a lot archived on YouTube, some of which are there to get you to try to buy the copyright, some of which are public domain and owned by the National Archive. There is some crazy stuff there. But if you look at, I initially was going to look for Reefer Madness, and if you look at the drug stuff, it's not only is it very much like, is there a certain affinity, isomorphism in representation of people getting drawn into a sinister set of activities that then, you know, ruins their lives and which spreads, you know, it destroys others as a contagion, much like the Red Menace is supposed to, but also even drugs are associated in some contexts with becoming a communist, right? That's one of the bads that will happen to you if you take too much drugs, is you'll become a red. Mm-hmm. By the way, one of the things I stumbled across was a 1960s film called, I think it was like How to Win with Brunettes, and it was for Navy servicemen about how to date women as a proper Navy serviceman, how to get what you want, including playing hard to get at the very beginning, deliberately showing late and being late and showing that you were busy. And it does let you know at the very beginning that it is an unclassified film.
Wow. Wow. Which suggests that there's a classified version? Good God. Wow.
But I urge anybody to go take a look through these archives. They're really pretty wild. And some of the anti-communist propaganda is really quite something.
Yeah.
How do you know a red? How do you know you might be a red if you do this? If you know you might be a red if you do that. Right. Some of the things are fairly innocuous, like reading labor newspapers.
Yeah.
Well, or, innocuous from our perspective, right. but
not from but gateway, the perspective of
gateway
time.
Gateway drugs to Marxist Leninism. Mm-hmm. Even if trade unionism is, of course, the enemy.
Right.
But okay, yeah, all right.
It's all the same.
So the War on Drugs chapter I really enjoyed, and the first time I read it, I really enjoyed it. Now it resonates for me a lot. I think that it also suggests that we've sort of puzzled about something we've been talking about offline. And we talked a little bit about it in the session that we lost, sort of didn't have a usable recording from, the relationship between writing security and securitization theory. And you know, I don't know enough about the intricacies of securitization theory to know what role this work played in securitization theory. There's clearly a very strong family resemblance. Clearly this gets cited in securitization work. I think somebody, Thierry, Balzac, is Thierry. I think he has a piece that describes different approaches to critical security studies, which separates this from securitization theory. But now I'm really hazy. I don't remember. But here I think that one of the lessons I would say is that from the perspective of writing security, securitization theory is a subset of writing security. It's a particular manifestation of this dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one that is specifically about the kind of depoliticizing or suspension of normal politics, where I think Campbell's ambit is broader than that, because you can have also the particular framings of danger and threat don't always result in the suspension of normal politics. They can actually just be normal politics. So
well, that's what I was going to say. I think if I remember correctly that I saw this once listed as one group of kind of critical security studies versus another group in which they were separated, or maybe as being more critical securitization theory. I mean, for Campbell, this is normal politics. Mm-hmm. So the whole distinction between abnormal and normal politics and securitization theory is wrong. Nonetheless, the mechanisms and dynamics are, I think you're exactly right, they're a subset. Mm-hmm. The last chapter in the original edition is one of our favorites, and it's not in the new edition, you tell me, or the second edition, but that is this chapter on Japan.
Yes.
Showing which ways, if you think the Cold War is, the Cold War with quotation marks is over, look, we have already been in the process of constituting Japan using the same toolkit, using the same representational practices or very similar ones, drawing on the same well of representations and strategies.
And you get, once again, the recurrence of the disease notions, disease and infiltration stuff. You get the notions of civilization and civilization versus barbarism, and you get the individuality equals freedom kind of language that you've seen on display in some of the earlier things. Though what's kind of clever about Campbell doing this in the first edition is he's talking in most of the book about sort of typical high politics security stuff. Then you get the war on drugs, at least that's sort of a war, so it's still kind of security. But now we're talking about economic relations. So he's showing that this extends much further even than the domain, the sort of typical realist, you know, classic realist domain of the military, right? This is not just about military relations and not just about sovereign states sort of negotiating with each other. This is also about trade, which of course is famously low politics rather than high politics, right? So he's trying to show how ubiquitous these things are by turning to a supposedly economic case and saying, look, we're doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. There's a great section also in this chapter which theoretically I was found really profound, but it's not, unfortunately, not in the second edition, which is the section.
What is it replaced with in the second edition?
In the second edition, this is replaced with the epilogue, the disciplinary politics of identity, which I'll talk briefly about at the end here. So look, you know, the discussion starts out on page 235, where he's talking about sort of criticizing the notion of an archetype, right? And does a really nice job differentiating between a way of characterizing these sorts of rhetorics that are being directed by various Americans against Japan. He says it's not enough to call them stereotypes or archetypes or formulaic expressions. There's something wrong with that sort of theoretical characterization. And then this is a marvelous sentence. What we have to try and express, sort of instead, is the way in which each confrontation between self and other is both a creative and original act, yet involving the reproduction of dominant dispositions and orientations, so that we are sensitive both to the patterns and the disjunctions. So it's not as if you can kind of see these patterns and then abductively infer back to some sort of real dispositional essence of the ways in which we characterize the other. Instead, it's here are certain kinds of recurrent scripts. We can see these recurrent scripts. There's continuity in these scripts. There's also innovation and creativity in the particular ways they get deployed by particular people in particular circumstances. So there's a nice interplay there that if you just called them stereotypes, well, but then we've kind of reified it and we've turned it into like a thing that's just is always constant. And we've eliminated that element of like creative agency.
Thoughts on the final chapter of the first edition and of the final chapter in the revised edition, the epilogue in the revised edition?
Well, what was the conclusion of the first edition and the almost conclusion of the second edition is a really nice moment where like Campbell draws back the curtains and shows you exactly how much Foucault has gone into this. So it's really just, I mean, like my notes on chapter 8 start off by saying the full Foucault. It's like, we're just going to do it. Here we are. Criticism is making facile gestures difficult. Biopower, governmentality, figure of sovereign man, like all of this stuff is there. And what's great about it is he's shown you in previous chapters what all this stuff does. So this comes at the end. This is a nice drawing together of it and sort of demonstrating that taking this kind of Foucauldian perspective is really the way to cut into these things, or a particularly useful way to cut into these things.
It's an interesting move because usually that kind of theoretical exegesis, well, usually the summary of somebody else, some other prominent theorist's theory would occur at the front of a book like this. So we would wade through 5 to 10 pages on Foucault, depending how important Foucault was. And you're right, bringing it after changes the character a lot. It means that he is, as I suggested earlier, he's drawing on lots of different people. It doesn't feel like it's being forced to fit a framework. And I actually think that, well, it's true that there was a lot of Foucault here. I think the de-Foucaultization of the main body of the theory makes it much more multivocal and also demonstrates that it's not necessarily quite as dependent on Foucault
as maybe he,
it's funny. We've talked about this a lot when we've been involved in advising people together or separately, the idea that a lot of people feel like they need to show their intellectual work in a way that they don't, mm-hmm. In the sense that, the entire journey of how you got to where you are is not something that you need to reproduce for your reader. And this is a kind of interesting alternative strategy but again, it's not the entire intellectual journey either. It's more, mm-hmm.
It's nice because Campbell doesn't want to say, and he's very clear throughout the book that he doesn't want to say, I have a theoretical account which allows me to generate superior facts about a situation, and therefore you should believe me. Like, that's not the game here. Instead, the game is, here are interesting insights that we generate if we start in a different place than we traditionally would start. And let me explain to you sort of how we would get there, and then draw out some of the implications of what we've now learned. And then Foucault, in that sense, becomes not the reason why we should be doing this, but Foucault becomes a theorist of the implications of us having done this, as it were. So in a way, it makes perfect sense that the book sort of leads you to Foucault rather than starts with Foucault and then does a Foucauldian analysis. Instead, it's I'm doing this analysis, and it turns out that this is going to be well illuminated by these things that Foucault has said. The thing that's fascinating to me about the difference in tone between that conclusion and then the epilogue.
Yeah, I was going to ask, you should just talk about it because I've never read the epilogue.
I mean, the epilogue is such a...
I assume it's pissed off.
It's pissed. The epilogue is a marvelous encapsulation of what late 90s IR was like if you were more of a post-structuralist. Because then you watched various people under the heading of constructivism saying forms sort of what you'd been saying before and been ignored or vilified for, and now people were saying it, and they were the ones who were able to sort of do what they were doing, and you weren't. But also the cost of the kinds of constructivist analyses, he goes after the culture of national security, and he goes after Wendt, and he goes after a lot of the kind of mainstream Anglophone constructivist stuff, and he goes after it primarily for having sacrificed its politics, having sacrificed its political edge, so that instead it would simply be an analysis of identity rather than a critical disruption of the way that the logics of identity work.
And when is this from?
1998.
So it predates, it was written before Ashley read Alex Riot Act.
Yes.
Because that happened in 1990. No, that happened in 1999.
That happened in 2000. 2000? That happened in 2000. So this is happening a little bit earlier than that. But it's also fascinating. I mean, he goes after everybody in this introduction. He goes after Ivor. I mean, he goes after Ivor. He accuses Ivor Newman of being engaged in the blackmail of the Enlightenment.
I don't even know what that means.
Well, in context, on page 223... What he argues is Newman is evidently empathetic with the case for the ontological impossibility of a secure and self-enclosed self. He believes post-structuralists dwell upon this at the expense of a concern with the epistemology of identity. The argument of Newman and others replicates what Foucault called the blackmail of the Enlightenment. Instead of opting for either-or renderings of the theoretical and political choices we face, i.e. problematizing subjectivity equates with the end of agency and the death of the subject, a more sustained critique of the limits that are imposed on us and an experiment with the possibility of going beyond them has to be achieved. So there, now you could read this one of two ways. You could say the epilogue is like a radicalization of what Campbell did before, or the epilogue is honestly what Campbell did before, but it was sort of misread. The radical implications of it were a bit misread.
Well, not misread, simply not adopted or right. You know, by most of the people who were.
But
I mean, the majority of people reading Campbell, inciting Campbell. We're simply not adopting the more radical aspects of the program.
They were either not adopting it or they weren't seeing it, and it's a little hard to tell. Campbell goes after a lot of the reviews of Writing Security and a lot of the receptions of Writing Security in there and sort of says, well, okay, well, they're missing this, they're not looking at this. Regardless of whether it's a deliberate not adoption or a misreading, it is clear that the radical implications of Writing Security were not the ones that were adopted. The arguments from this book that sort of made it out into the wider parts of the field were arguments about, you know, rhetorical causation, mechanisms, identity, the importance of culture, things like this, the sort of themes that were then picked up by constructivists. Campbell is at pains in the epilogue to point out that he's not a constructivist, and to argue that his work is not a constructivist work. And again, where he draws the line is he draws this line on the question of politics, that constructivism is all about analyzing categories of identity rather than radically disrupting them. And Writing Security was supposed to be about radically disrupting categories, and that's what the work we should be doing is the radical disruption of categories. It's critique. It's a form of intervention to pry open the space for alternatives. And what constructivists are doing is not that, and therefore he's not a constructivist. Campbell's version of this certainly represents a path that was not taken by a large number of mainstream Anglophone constructivists who sort of went off in a different kind of direction. I mean, he doesn't go after, like, Nick Onuf doesn't get mentioned in here, so that sort of constructivism is not the target. It's really more about kind of Anglophone mainstream IR not having gone in this kind of critical post-structural direction. There are parts of that epilogue that I think I would characterize as bitter. The tone is very bitter. You know? These are points that were made, and people should have taken them more seriously and gone in this direction, and they did not. And it is the same kind of tone as the Ashley Wendt confrontation in 2000, I think, encapsulates. A sense of betrayal of the critical project by people who were interested in doing something that was closer to mainstream Anglophone social science. More explanatory, less critical, if you will.
That makes sense. I mean, this is the problem then with Ivor, right, is that Ivor is playing in the same theoretical sandbox, unlike most mainstream constructivists, but he's not interested. I mean, he's just not really all that interested in the critical emancipatory side of things. I mean, he's perfectly happy to problematize stuff, but, you know, he's more interested in kind of, I mean, ultimately, I think Ivor wants to explain things.
Yeah. And I really think that, I mean, as I have gotten older, the more I think that's where the line goes. It's, is there an explanatory intent, or is there primarily a critical emancipatory kind of intent? And you can sort of do both, but you ultimately, I think, veer toward one side or the other. And it's clear that Campbell, and this is fascinating to me, sort of looking back at this, it's clear to me, from especially that epilogue, that even though I read Campbell in an explanatory sense, that's clearly not what he wanted to do. That this is not an explanatory book. That this is a critical book. The explanation.
Well, that's why I was.
Yeah, the explanation is in passing. So, whereas I think what you and I both grab onto here is the explanatory elements.
Yes, I mean I think that's right. Although I don't think the critical argument is very hard to see, and I don't think. So there are like two dimensions of the critical argument. There's the critical argument that shows the ways in which practices of self-order, other boundary maintenance, involve a politics of fear and threat that is deeply damaging to a lot of different people in a lot of different times in a lot of different places, and that constitutes a whole set of power relations which are pretty awful in a lot of their manifestations. And then also the ways in which it compels, presumably, a lot of actual danger, right? By, you know, if you have to transform something into the kind of threat that you would need to stabilize your identity, then you are constantly, of course, engaged in this sort of stuff. And as he shows in some of the empirical chapters, you get all of this kind of domestic repression as a result. So there's that kind of aspect of it. And then there's the radical aspect of it, which says that the project of sort of conventional IR by separating foreign policy from foreign policy, taking for granted reinscribing the very boundaries that are necessary to keep, you know, to keep this machine going, so to speak. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's the critical edge is not, I mean, I'm not saying anything all that exciting. The critical edge to me is, I think, and there are a bunch of different valences, but it's clearly a critical project in the sense that it is trying to displace a lot of assumptions to uncover the ways in which they then produce a set of exclusions and power relations. I just don't know. I mean, to me, I don't think everybody's obligated to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is kind of my view. I mean, I think this book is clearly extremely important intellectually to me and to you.
Yeah.
Clearly influenced very profoundly, more profoundly than I remembered. I don't know David Campbell, so I can't speak to his views about what happened in the field. And I know there is a group of scholars that I would describe as critical, who are crucial to the evolution of what I would describe as capital C constructivism with a V, who definitely felt like they were left out in the cold, right? Who must have felt at some point like they are on the brink of a revolution. And then that got pulled and this sort of dispersed to the winds, right? Although there's a lot of it outside of the United States in various places. And in some places in the United States, to be fair. And so I think, and I don't want to psychologize, but I do think that if you are primarily angry with constructivists for betraying the revolution, your anger is probably misplaced. Because the lesson of the evolution of constructivism is in part, yes, people who drew inspiration from some more radical work, and also Cindy Weber's work, other, you know, and yet were trained or disposed towards a more conventional idiom. Yeah, there's that. There are people I would describe that way. But more generally, I think it's a lesson of survivor bias. What you needed to do to actually land influential jobs in the American Academy, if you were going to pursue this kind of work, was not critical.
Mm-hmm.
It was not primarily concerned, first and foremost, for public decision, or did not wear it on its sleeve, even if that was really what you were about. And so the problem is not a bunch of constructivists appropriated these arguments and got fame and glory. The problem is that that was the only way to really achieve sufficient academic capital to have influence. And that's a problem that's structural with the field. So the problem isn't that constructivists are denudating critical theory. The problem is that the field is not tolerant enough of or the field is not willing to say that this is so legitimate that we must have it in our department. And so we do not need to hire somebody who does this kind of work. That's the problem, not this other stuff. And it's not how the field should be. I think we would be enriched. You know, I mean, look, I mean, remember Jack thinking that we were all going to be fine, Jack Snyder, because everybody was going to want to have to hire a constructivist, and it didn't turn out that way.
No, not at all.
Right? I mean, the moment, the constructivist window was brief. That could be read as, you know, you make a pact with the devil and you get thrown under the bus. But I don't think it's a devil. I just think it's a discipline that needs to have more, just needs to be more heterogeneous and needs to find ways to create academic capital, which is more heterogeneous. I mean, that's the...
Right.
issue here.
And part of that, I think, had to do with, it wasn't about substantive claims or theory. It was about methodology and about what it meant to make a claim and what kind of evidence was going to be appropriate for supporting a claim and how broad and general claims needed to be. And we had a really bad vocabulary for describing methodology. So at the very beginning of this conversation, we talked about the way that Campbell is sort of, you know, loosely using terms like epistemic realism. And at the time, that was sort of what people did, right? That was sort of the level of the discourse was. If anything's changed in the last, when did this come out? 92? Almost 30 years ago? Mm-hmm. Yeah. 28 years ago, isn't it? I think we're more sophisticated about some of our methodological discussions now. I think there's a different kind of vocabulary for this. I don't think that's translated into broader hiring in the U.S. in the sense you're talking about. It's not like everybody goes and says, "Oh, now we got to make sure we've got our we need somebody who does critical methodology." But I think that if nothing else, we've become more sophisticated in the way that we talk about some of these concerns, and there is some space open in different places now to be able to sort of do the sort of work and say, yes, okay, this is considered legitimate work. Now, that's not the full thing that I agree with you. It sounded like, you know, certainly people, so there were a group of scholars that thought in the late 80s, early 90s that they were really on the verge of actually being able to do this full time and sort of make this central. No, that didn't work, but there are pockets, and there are certainly, the field is moved in interesting ways.
I mean, I do think that the type of problematization and disruption project here is still not, it's not ubiquitous,
no.
Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are a lot of people doing that kind of work, and there are a lot more, and a lot more doing work that is adjacent.
Yeah.
Right, where there is a political valence to the work, even if it's not always the focus of the work.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I'm thinking about some of the more radical practice turn people, right, who are really advancing a politics of subjectivity,
mm-hmm.
right, in their work. That's why they have certain disagreements with the sort of quote-unquote mainstream of the practice turn, right? It's not primarily, and there is a critical, there actually is what I would call a critical edge to that debate.
Yeah.
Because it has to do with the degree to which you are imposing analytic categories, right? As opposed to letting kind of practices endogenously percolate up and then, you know, making sense of them in a way that gives people their agency or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever you want to call it, there are people who are doing, there are people doing this kind of work. And there are certainly a lot of people who are doing work that is adjacent to this kind of work, and sufficiently adjacent that I don't think, you know, you would necessarily see it as Ivers style sellout, if Ivers a sellout, which I, you know, sorry, Ivor. But that being said, part of what happened, and some of the people who are in that position are of this generation, but primarily the second generation was what happened was a real move to playing disciplinary politics,
mm-hmm.
particularly in Europe. So the formation or taking control over journals, which allowed for outlets to publish in, combined with, and very importantly, combined in ways and then that you could drive up citation counts. A lot of it had to do with kind of European funding patterns. You can get a European Research Council grant.
Mm-hmm.
You can get a grant, as far as I understand, in Britain, doing critical work.
Yeah.
Which is virtually impossible in the United States, at least through our main, you know, NSF-style funding mechanism. So it was that. It was kind of the disciplinary politics. It was playing the game that has now allowed, you can go and you can find critical IR scholars who have citation counts that are comparable to the more successful people doing statistical work in the field. You can find them in positions of power. You can find fights over the spoils to some degree, fights within groups over, you know, control over journals or treatment of work, which is the kind of thing that you can get in very small kind of People's Liberation Front of Judea kind of circumstances. But I think here it's really a sign of growth and consolidation. So essentially people largely took their toys away with them, but they took a lot of toys and they set things up. And that's how this wound up, I think, happening, that you now have a point where critical work has a sufficient presence, but it is very siloed, but then all of the field is siloed now. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense?
It does. It does. You know, I quickly punched up Google Scholar. This book has been cited over 5,000 times.
Yeah, that's so pretty good.
It's certainly not that it hasn't been read and used. It has made an impact. And arguably, I mean, the non-adoption of the critical agenda has more to do with the way that the social sciences in the United States are constructed and the way that the social sciences in the U.S. are wrapped up with this kind of default neo-positivism to which this is simply not legible. Like, this project doesn't make any sense in those terms. But the book certainly shook up a lot of things. A lot of things fall out of it. A lot of interesting work is produced in dialogue with it over time. So even though the maximal revolution sort of doesn't happen, there's a lot more space. And I go back to, like, my favorite thing David Campbell's ever written was this piece that he and Jim George wrote together on thinking space. And it's just this marvelous notion that one of the things that we do in our scholarship, aside from whatever questions we're answering and whatever debates we're engaging in, is we can use our scholarly writing to produce thinking space, to produce openness to different ways of doing things. And that plea for thinking space, that made a great impact on me, just reading that, going, oh yes, that's one thing we should be trying to do with our writing, is not closing things down. We should be trying to open things up in various ways. And I think that the punchline here is that I think that this book did open thinking space, and it opened thinking space even in the people who are criticized in the epilogue for not going far enough. Space is still opened because of the sorts of moves that are made in this book and related scholarship at the time that was more critical radical.
I guess what I would say is that maybe the bottom line of what I've been trying to articulate about this is, it is frustrating if you're trying to push a research agenda and that research agenda, as you conceptualize it, is not picked up. Particularly if you have a certain attitude towards the politics of what you're doing, mm-hmm. and see your interventions as having a political edge, which is then kicked out of. But this has been such an influential book for so many people that the fact that it's spawned many different kinds of research programs, I think, is a kind of testament to it. And I hope that if there's a 30th anniversary edition, that aspect of it, the way that it has, it's done so much to push, to prod along so many people to do certain kinds of work, different kinds of work. I would hope that maybe is something that Campbell can look at and be pleased about.
Okay. I think it's an excellent sum, excellent summation.
So we started Whiskey and International Relations Theory about a decade ago in February of 2020. This is our final episode of the year. It's also our 14th episode. We want to thank everybody who's been listening and bearing with us as we erratically release installments. As I said at the outset, we're hoping to get a slightly more regular schedule in 2021. But of course, we all have a lot of hopes for 2021. It doesn't mean they'll be realized. I know that a number of you have asked for a complete whiskey list. I've asked Patrick to produce one. As soon as he gets a chance, we'll put it up, including on Facebook and on Twitter. Those are also the two places where we announce the books or the articles that we're going to be reading next. So it's a good place to go if you want to be reading along with us. However, we do know what our first podcast of 2021 is going to be about, and we're going to be reading an article, so hopefully not too arduous for many of you. We'll be reading J. Ann Tickner's You Just Don't Understand, Troubled Engagements Between Feminists and IR Theorists, which appeared in International Studies Quarterly in 1997 in volume 41, page 611 to 632. I always feel a bit of concern when Patrick and I, as two middle-aged white guys, read feminist theory, but I think so far nobody's gotten really angry at us, so we'll see if this works out okay as well. Until next time, have a terrific new year, stay safe, stay healthy, stay sane. See you next time, space theorist. Other really bad kind of cultural references I could use at the end? Are there? I don't know. Alas. Anyway, that's it. Gonna go now. Woohoo. Yeah. You know, I really ought to write out a script. I do fewer takes of this thing. Maybe the problem is that when I do the introductions and the conclusions to the episodes, I haven't had anything to drink. Is it good night and good luck? And that's the way it was. See you later, international relations theorists. Yeah. Bye.